You're listening to Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas, archived at antiwar.com. Well, you just heard conservative John Basil Utley, the director of Americans Against World Empire. And that really does bring up the question, doesn't it, about the left and the right and prospects for a new anti-war movement in this country. And that's the subject of our next interview. I always love to turn to my good friend Anthony Gregory from the Independent Institute when I have questions about such things. Welcome to the show, Anthony.
Hi, Scott. It's great to be here.
It's always good to have you on. And everyone, just so you know, Anthony Gregory is a research analyst at the Independent Institute, a policy advisor for the Future Freedom Foundation. He also writes for Liberty Magazine, Mises.org, LouRockwell.com, StrikeTheRoot.com, and AntiWar.com. It's quite a resume, and always highly recommend going back through Anthony's archives. And in fact, this one just popped right into my mind, so let's start here. Anthony, you wrote in early, I believe, maybe the spring of 2004 about the Iraqization scam. Was that article 3 years early?
Well, I guess so. I just came up with that term trying to think of something that sounded really stupid that people might start calling the plan to turn over security in Iraq to the Iraqis. And it seemed like, you know, I was just kind of joking with that title because I figured that's something the president might come up with, right? You know, Iraqization. But I noticed about a year ago, people started using the term more seriously. I'm not going to take too much credit for starting a trend or anything. I mean, all I did was take Vietnamization and
You were trying to make fun of them, and they just proved to you how dumb they really are.
Well, I suppose, yeah, some of the people using the term actually are in favor of this plan, but my point back then was they were talking about handing security issues over to the Iraqis gradually, and many people who were talking about this probably assumed the U.S. would be more out of there at this point than they are, more out of there than they were back then, when in fact, of course, the new plan that Bush unveiled for a surge is not really what a lot of people had in mind, but you know, we're still there, and everything is still chaotic. It seems the violence only it's mind-boggling, but it just gets worse and worse.
Yeah.
And the U.S. should have cut its losses and cut the losses of the Iraqis a couple of years ago, or 3 or 4 years ago, and left. But people didn't want it to. People were afraid that if the U.S. pulled out, it would develop into civil war. Which is
good thing we prevented that by our continued occupation, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
All right, now I want to go ahead and just show people really just how confusing these topics are of the left and right before if people are just raised knowing about conservatism and liberalism, in their own lifetime and what have you, they may not realize that, for example, right-wing Republicans used to be anti-war back when they were liberals, before they got infiltrated by the liberals. When I first learned about stuff like that, it kind of threw me for a loop. And so hopefully I just threw some people in the audience for a loop, and you can help straighten them back out again, Anthony. How is it that right-wing Republicans used to be anti-war back when they were liberals, before they got infiltrated by the liberals? What the hell am I talking about?
Well, of course, the problem is all of these labels are very imperfect, and they change with the times, and they can be very deceptive, especially if you try to look back at history, and they can get anachronistic, and there are a lot of misnomers. What you're talking about is the old right, which was the movement, not really even a coalition, but the loose movement of people who opposed FDR first in his domestic policies, including. Who were seen as liberals, and including some, you know, social democrats of the Democrat Party who thought that FDR was going too far with some of his nationalization of the economy. And what I guess many of people would call conservatives, too. And then they also opposed the drive to World War II. At the time, most Americans had seen World War I, had seen that it had not wrought the end of war and end of tyranny worldwide that was promised of it. And so they were wary of a new global intervention. So the biggest mobilization or movement against war in American history was probably the America First movement to oppose entry into World War II.
These people weren't so much conservatives as they were individualist, pro-capitalism liberals, opposed to FDR liberals.
Well, they were, I mean, that's the thing. They weren't really either one. I mean, you had people like H.L. Mencken that was seen at times as being on the left, and many people think his views became more conservative. But as far as skepticism of central power, of big government, and of war were concerned, he didn't really change his views that much. It's just that the political dynamics around him changed. And the interesting thing about the old right, one thing that interests me even more than the World War II is after World War II, when Harry Truman had taken over, and unlike any president before him, really, at the end of a huge American war, didn't really retract the U.S. empire and warfare state, instead kept it going, and he launched the Cold War, which of course is the anti-commie war that most people associate with the right wing. But in the beginning, it was the Democrats and the social Democrats and the left liberals, pretty much everyone on the left except the communists, for obvious reasons, supported the Cold War and supported the drive to war with Korea. And most of the mainstream dissent was seen on the right, including among Republicans. But a lot of this was situational. It was just because the Democrats were in power. And left and right, you know, who knows what these mean. Of course, it wasn't that long into the Cold War that things changed, that the establishment right made the Cold War pretty much its one issue. And everything else took a back seat to the Cold War. And being, you know, a very, very anti-war libertarian, I'm often told that that those of us who put war first, put opposing the warfare state first, are missing a big picture. We should instead be working to cut marginal tax rates or institute vouchers. And I'm for genuine free market reforms, no matter how small, though I have problems with some of the reforms touted as free market. But the war is, if anything, is the most important issue. It's war. And you see this because the warmongers think so. For the pro-war establishment, for the right now the Republican loyalists who still support the Iraq war, despite the fact that almost everyone else doesn't, including many Republicans, for them, war is the most important issue. You were a traitor if you opposed going to Iraq. Domestic policy didn't really matter that much. And, of course, they don't really care, many of them, all this culture war stuff, much of it's a distraction, which is, you know, the religious right will back, you know, pretty much any politician that says he's religious and has an R by his name, and especially if he wages war. Unfortunately, people get distracted by these aesthetic and rhetorical and cosmetic issues regarding Republicans and Democrats, and that's why we have two parties that govern nearly identically. There's some slight differences in their priorities, but really what they're pretty much the same. I mean, Bush just submitted his $2.9 trillion budget.
Go ahead and round up and call it three. It'll be three.
It'll be more than three, and of course there's off-budget items.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the war, which is supposedly the government's major function, they don't even bother, you know, budgeting that.
Yeah, never mind the intelligence budgets or any of that stuff either.
Sure. So Bush has more than half again expanded the federal government since he's taken power, and a lot of it, of course, is driven by the war, or at least obscured by the war, but a lot of it's also domestic government expansion, and both parties just want to expand their power. Mm-hmm. And
well, you once explained to me, Anthony, that the liberals used to be basically what we now call libertarians, and that when they became, you know, progressive socialist big government types, that they were behind. The conservatives had already been progressive big government people for 100 years or something, and that what the liberals did was made the mistake of trying to use conservative means to achieve liberal ends, and that what they did basically was destroy liberalism. So what ended up happening was conservatives, who were always for big government, progressivism, regulation of the economy, protectionism, war, etc., they began to look like the small government people on the side of freedom in comparison to how radical some of the left-wingers had become.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. The conservatives, and again, these terms, you know, conservative, for the most part, as people think of it today, is a Cold War invention. And, you know, right wing too. These terms that, you know, the right and left used to apply to the French legislature, and they got some traction. But these words are used more now that they mean even less. But in the back in the day, from the beginning of the Republic, mercantilism was the ruling statist ideology of those who wanted to expand government. And they were very open about wanting to do this for the benefit of big business.
You're talking about the Hamiltonians.
Yeah, the Hamiltonians, Henry Clay, the Republican Party from Lincoln to Teddy Roosevelt, and to this day, they've often been associated with being pro big business and thus anti-government. But that's just incoherent, and it flies in the face of facts. The Republicans and the establishment conservatives have always been for expanding government, for these big business, big government partnerships, kind of a fascism, really, in their economics, privatizing profits to their cronies while socializing costs to the taxpayers. So they've never been for small government, and back in the day, it was more or less the liberals who believed in liberty, believed in the common man, and they opposed big government, and they tended to be very suspicious of huge corporations, too, because they often worked hand-in-hand with the state. But then toward the end of the 19th century, the left kind of became corrupted more and more by socialism, by Marxism, and that's right, they try to liberate the worker using the state, which is on top of everything else, it's naive. I mean, to think that the government is going to side with the small guy against the big guy. I mean,
who already owns the government in the first place.
Right, sure. And, you know, you can pile on all this egalitarian legislation, but much of it is still going to be implemented for the benefit of those who already, for the haves. So,
well, let me stop you right there. It's very interesting the way you describe the system of economics, the American system, as Henry Clay called it in the 19th century, mercantilism, basically welfare for people who are already rich, and that really America's never had a free market capitalist system, but always protectionism and subsidy and regulation on behalf of the biggest companies against their competitors.
Sure, and of course, because the government was much smaller and less involved in American daily life, it was closer to a free market, but yes, most of the interventions that did exist existed for big business, for the banks, for the merchants of death, as they used to be called, the arms manufacturers, and all of that. And we see that today, where you know, the Republicans aren't about small government. That should be clear to everyone by now. I hope so. Some people are still deluded about it, but you know, Bush makes Clinton look like a, you know, laissez-faire at times.
Yeah, I think all the Republicans understand. The only people who would still argue with you about that are people who call themselves libertarians.
You know, that's true. That's true. Sometimes it's ironic. You know, I find that libertarians, of course, being one, I don't want to attack other libertarians too much, but a lot of them are still naive about the Republicans, how their devotion to free enterprise. It's because, you know, Bush cut taxes nominally a little bit, and so he's supposedly better, but in actuality, he's far worse than Clinton, just in terms of how much he's expanded the power and size of government. and the reach of it. But, you know, it's hard to know what Clinton would have done had he been president after 9/11 and had he been president during the drive to war. I'm not prepared to say that it would have been better for sure or worse for sure. We never know. And which brings us to the fact that all of these top Democratic, all of the candidates people are looking for to replace the Republicans and finally return America to pre-Iraq war normalcy, these people are all warmongers. And if you look at their statements, you know, they support the war. Sometimes they'll say the war was bungled. And sure, it's possible the Bush administration has been particularly incompetent in ways, but if there's one criticism of the war I'm sick of hearing, it's that it's bungled, that it's mismanaged, because it implies that if another president had been in power, the U.S. could have decapitated the Iraqi state, instituted its version of martial law for a while, you know, picked favorites over there, and done all of this crazy stuff that supposedly is going to turn, you know, Iraq, a more or less artificial state of several somewhat, you know, opposed factions into some sort of American version democracy. I mean, it's absurd, and it's a little bit arrogant to think that the U.S. could have done this if it weren't for Bush. He might have bungled it worse than he might have, but the Democrats, when they say that he's messed it up, that doesn't speak well for our prospects for peace in the future, because what are they going to do? And when they get power and you listen to their critiques of the war, and one of their main critiques of the war over time is he's neglecting other threats. He's neglecting Iran. Well, thanks,
yeah, that's
Democrats.
What Hillary Clinton says.
Yeah, that's what she's been saying this for a couple years now. She's been getting louder about it, how Bush is being too soft on Iran. And, you know, that's not the kind of, that's not very helpful, because it seems that there's this premise that everyone accepts, almost everyone accepts, that Iran is a threat, a big threat, that they're pursuing nuclear weapons, or they're very dangerous, and the U.S. government has to do something about it. And I don't know I kind of do know, but it's sad at any rate that this is such a widely, you know, this premise is taken for granted by almost everyone across the spectrum, that it's the U.S. government's job to police the world. Maybe Bush is a brutal cop who didn't police the world right, but once Hillary or Obama gets in there, we can police the world correctly. Now, of course, I'm not saying the next Republican would be better than a Democrat would be either. They're all warmongers, and the problem is American culture needs to move away from its warmongering, because the Americans have long been somewhat imperialistic, believed in national greatness of one type or another, manifest destiny. It's probably only gotten worse, you know, since the 20th century, and in some ways even worse after World War II, America's imperialism and their desire to be, you know, hegemonically rule the whole world. But Americans, as a people, if we're going to be peaceful, if we want peace as a country, it's going to require ideology to shift. And I think we're seeing it somewhat in that the Iraq War, as horrific as it's been, and in some ways it has been one of the most strategically atrocious and kind of ridiculous projects, and of course it's horrifying, and every week there's more death and destruction, but on the other hand, if there is a silver lining, it's that there's been resistance and a change of mind quicker than we've seen, say during Vietnam, where the buildup went for a while, and then there was far more American deaths and more foreign deaths before the average American said, "Now wait a minute, maybe this isn't a good idea. Maybe the Iraq War was so stupid that people should have realized this before it began." I certainly think so, but there's a bright side. I mean, some of the civil liberties stuff that we've lost during this war, these attacks, and they're significant. I mean, they suspended habeas corpus with the Military Commissions Act, right? I mean, that's the first time Congress ever legislated the end of habeas corpus since the Civil War when Lincoln did it, and then they eventually more or less rubber-stamped his edict. And I mean, this is serious stuff, you know, the attacks on the Fourth Amendment and the surveillance and the torture, but I think that there's a possibility that Americans are more resistant to it, they're less tolerant of some of this than they were in the World Wars. World War One, they jailed dissenters, you know, they locked up, any of, if you critique the war, if you even criticize the flag or an ally, if you criticize Britain during World War One, you could be jailed for sedition. And
Wilson even had a movie producer jailed for portraying the British badly in a movie that he was making about the American Revolution.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Bernard Goldman's
God, I wish I had just made that up, but that's real, isn't it?
Yeah, he's the Spirit of 76, a movie, a patriotic movie about the Revolution that showed the British as the villains, and he was sentenced to, I believe he was sentenced to 10 years, but he was definitely sentenced to years. And a lot of these people, or most of them, maybe almost all of them, were pardoned by Harding.
So the people who say that Bush is the worst president in American history just don't know anything about Woodrow Wilson, do they?
Well, yeah, I would say the thing is, though, there are people who do know about Woodrow Wilson who I'll see them actually still say, no, Bush might be the worst. And they put up kind of a good argument, but in terms of the actual damage he's caused so far, I don't think that Bush is the worst. I think that he's in the top 10 worst, and maybe even higher than that. But
when I talked to Gabriel Kolko the other day, he said, Bush is no worse than average. He's just like the rest of them.
Well, that's the kind of leftist understanding I like. One way that when talking to a leftist, one question I like to ask when they're attacking Bush is what they think of, say, Harry Truman, because of course everyone's a partisan and Harry Truman was a Democrat, considered a liberal or whatever, so he must be good, whereas Bush is this horrible bloodthirsty warmonger. Well, Harry Truman ended World War II by nuking hundreds of thousands of innocent people unnecessarily, and then he launched the Cold War and went into Korea and slaughtered, you know, perhaps millions of innocent North Koreans, and so you know,
don't forget Operation Keel Haul.
Oh yeah, that's right. You know, at the end of World War II, when they rounded up 1-2 million refugees who had escaped the communist, the Soviet Union, and they rounded them up and put them on boxcars and shipped them back to Stalin, where they knew that they would be, because these were refugees, that Stalin would exact revenge on them, and many of them, they were worked to death and killed. And, of course, Truman was terrible in his domestic policy, too, but it's funny, you know, the left hates Bush, and they should, but what Bush is doing isn't all that different qualitatively from a lot of things that Wilson did, Truman, FDR, Lyndon Johnson.
Well,
not
now,
to say only Democrats, of course, you know, Nixon. There were Republicans that were very horrible, too, in recent times.
Well, now, when you ask left-wingers these questions about Harry Truman, have their answers been significantly altered at all due to the George Bush experience in the last few years?
Well, one unfortunate thing about this, about Bush being president, where do I begin with unfortunate things about Bush being president? One really unfortunate thing is that it's perpetuated this false understanding that free markets and capitalism go hand in hand with war, which is the Republican version of capitalism does, the state capitalism. But of course, free markets are the opposite of war, because they're the opposite of government intervention, the opposite of coercion in the economy, free markets properly understood. And so the left has, they seem to understand to some degree that power, huge, you know, federal power as it is, maybe it's so bad, maybe it's so bungling that and unpredictably disastrous that we can't, you know, trust it, this much power, even in the hands of a Clinton or of a Democrat. And there's some hope, but it's hard to know. I think the most disheartening thing for me in the Bush administration, as far as the left is concerned and their understanding, was during Katrina. It was the aftermath of Katrina, which was a natural disaster, but the real disaster was, of course, the government levees, which broke and flooded New Orleans. The federal response was dictatorial, corralling people into convention centers, unleashing people who had come from Iraq, the troops, and saying, shoot looters and all this. And there was basically martial law. It was terrible, and people rounding up people's guns and, forcing people into buses, and it was really...
And they said, everybody agrees, apparently, that this was a major failure on the part of the federal government, but it never seemed that way to me. It always seemed like FEMA did exactly what they were supposed to do, which is not rescue people from their attic where they're drowning. Their job is to ensure the continuity of government.
Right, right. It's a police state organization, and they did... The government... The thing that upset me a little bit, or frustrated me, was a lot of the left said, oh my God, the federal government's neglecting them. When in fact, private charities and people and community and the spontaneous order of people wanting to help one another was being actively suppressed by the federal government. They were saying, no, Red Cross, you can't go in there. And it wasn't a matter of the feds neglecting. It was a matter of the feds getting in the way, just as they usually get in the way. And the other thing about the left in this war is some of them still think, the U.S. went in there, they broke Iraq, they've created a big mess, and the U.S. needs to stay until it fixes things. And this betrays some sort of naive view that the U.S. government can fix things, when it's just going to get worse and worse,
It's right, and never mind the morality of fixing up a place where the owner has already asked you politely 10 times to leave. He'll clean up the mess himself, thank you very much.
Oh, yeah, sure. You go into Pottery Barn is the metaphor, right? And you break the pot, and it's like, was it Kerry that said you're supposed to stay and fix it?
No, it was Colin Powell is who it was.
Oh, it's Colin Powell, yeah. It became such a soundbite, I remember a lot of people talking about it. But, yeah, that's exactly right. If you break something in a Pottery Barn and they tell you to leave, you should leave. And, according to all the polls I've seen, Iraqis want the U.S. out. But the one sad thing about all this is the conservatives, to this day, they've been naive and hypocritical, very much so, about this too. Because back in the day, as long as 10 years ago, when a government program was going really poorly in America, they would say, end it or cut it back, because adding to it's not going to fix it. Whereas, the Democrats would always say, mend it, don't end it. But that's the conservative attitude now, or some of them are starting to come around. But for the last few years, the attitude was, oh, look at all this progress. They're building schools. The U.S. government is building infrastructure. This was after the U.S. government destroyed a lot of it, of course. But it was really, it was odd to hear this argument that the U.S. government should be boasted for planning the Iraqi economy, for doing all of these socialistic things that conservatives used to say the government shouldn't even do here.
Right, and but of course, as you've already pointed out, they were being hypocrites when they pretended to oppose those things. The Republican Party has always been in favor of that kind of government intervention, whether here or abroad. And I'm sorry, because we're just going to have to leave it at that. We're all out of time. Anthony Gregory, he's a research analyst at the Independent Institute, writes for the Future Freedom Foundation, Liberty Magazine, Mises.org, LouRockwell.com, StrikeTheRoot.com, AntiWar.com, and occasionally at my blog, thestressblog.com. Thanks for your time, Anthony.
Thank you, Scott.
All right, this has been Anti-War Radio for February 8th, 2007. Check out my blog, thestressblog.com. Check out the best website in the whole world, antiwar.com. And why not do yourself and the doofus behind you in traffic a favor and check out the Scott Horton section at libertystickers.com.